welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and we're here helping you by giving you all this great content and understanding the Constitution. As a matter of fact, we're literally going through, I think, where Madison really helps legislators understand the nuts and bolts of this Constitution. These are critical communications so that they can understand what they have to do to interpose and to hold that federal government accountable. It is likened to what we need our counties to do to hold our state government accountable to that Constitution that the counties created to create that state. And ergo, this begs this huge question. I'm yelling from the top of the highest mountains. Create your county constitutions. Now, I know everybody probably wants help and needs help. No problem. But I don't think this is rocket science. I think you can look at the federal Constitution. And first thing you have to do is you have to create a committee as to what powers you want your county, you know, services, the government to pay for, health care. You want health care, government involved in regulating and paying for health care. Because by identifying what services you need and want your government to pay for, because it's going to come out of your pockets, county, nobody else is going to subsidize you. You need to be able to pay for yourself, because this concept of a federal government being able to print money to just basically put us into debt, that is not constitutional, nor would it be constitutional, nor it'd be, you know, prudent for you as a county, or for us as the people of a county, to try to create a government that would be expanding beyond our capability of supporting it. It's just wrong. It's wrong for anybody to put their hand out and say, help me. Especially if we're willing, capable, and have the capacity of sustaining ourselves, we must do that. And we must sustain within those parameters. So, and as a matter of fact, I'd love to see this nation become so holy and so prosperous and so well done, you know, in God's eyes, that, you know, we no longer have, but we'll always have some sick and afflicted. But I think that would be really just, I don't want to say noise level. It will always be there so that we have to tend to that. But I believe as we as a nation tend to those things and have the pouring out of our bowels of compassion, that we're serving each other as well as building this nation in a, I'll just call it in a form of enlightenment, where we're reaching levels of technology and capabilities and so forth that nobody can even fathom at this point, that I believe that we will, you know, we will get to a point where we can reduce the suffering to be so marginal that only those who suffer are suffering because of the consequences of their decisions. That's it. You don't want to be a part of this, and you want to go out there, you want to get addicted to drugs? We're so sorry. The empirical data we've provided you should have been more than enough, but if you've got to throw yourself into the arms of you know, the hazards and the risks and so forth, then okay. Godspeed, and hopefully you survive. Hopefully you survive and come back and rejoin us in this enlightened society. But don't ask us to enable you by giving you money to pay for your hive, be able to, you know, pay for your health care as you trash your body. These are the consequences. I mean, it's just wrong for somebody to expect other people to do those things. We need to get to that point as a society to say, you know, it's okay. We leave that to the family. We leave, if the family wants to go, you know, the, what do they call that? Welcome back, Tammy. Welcome back, Sean. There's a word for it, the tough way or something, whatever. I don't want to say the tough way, the highway, but when the hard knocks. If they want the children.
Intervention.
Well, if they want to intervene, yes. But if they actually want their children to, you know, skin their knees and go out and take the brunt of the consequences, you're on your own. Hard knocks. If that's what the parents want to do, then society should actually back off and not undermine what those parents had decided for their children. Do you see my point? It's almost wrong for society to basically say, hey, you know, you've got an adult child that you still have this responsibility for because they're off doing these things, and go, let them suffer. These are their choices. We brought them up properly. These are choices that they're making, and these are the consequences that they must learn to either, you know, embrace the consequences of their decisions or change their decisions. Wow, imagine that. Imagine that we actually empower those people that who have probably the most skin in the game in deciding what to be done with these people. But if those people are saying, hey, I want you to help pay for my mistakes in raising my kids, then that becomes a problem. Because, you know, here we've got people that, you know, don't want to even have the brunt of the consequences for their misgivings and their mistakes. Anyway, when we get to this point of enlightenment, it's all about discipline, and it's all about helping everybody understand that, you know, we have to make our own decisions for ourselves. We can't save you. We all have to save ourselves in His name. And so, Sean, go ahead. What you got?
No, I was just going to say, on the other end of that same argument is the empowering of people who would use that to benefit themselves, like bringing drugs in, like the whole OxyContin scandal, where they skirted the regulations and used their power to put this out in the public as being advertised as one thing and, you know, things hidden or the COVID vaccine, where the corporations are just allowed to do whatever they want because they have the right connections within the government, and they're using the government for their own nefarious purposes. Like, yes, you were talking about on the bottom end, where you have people who are have addiction problems and they want the state to help them. Right. You know, the people shouldn't pay for that, but the people shouldn't allow the government to be used as, you know, a corporation's own personal ability to make more money for themselves at the expense of the public.
Yeah, so I think
what I'm saying is it goes on both ends. And I think the higher end is more to scale, because it's like I said, with the OxyContin, and now you have all this fentanyl coming in the country because the government is not doing their constitutional duty, and that's putting people at risk.
Right, so when we look at taking back the county and defining what your county government's going to do, it doesn't account for pharmaceutical support. It doesn't account for medical support. So it's one thing for your county to actually work out in a state constitution, you know, how they want this to be done. And I honestly believe if we go back to the fundamental roots that brought us to where we got today before these large corporations, profit-bearing corporations, took over, because we had a great medical system that was being operated by the churches. Awesome medical system. They were very compassionate, and they were putting their money where their mouth is. They were doing the research and so forth. It wasn't until the corporations came in to start actually competing and shutting them down and going after the corporations for taking care of people instead of making them sick so that they could become permanent consumers of their products and crap. So this is where, at the county level, the strategies have to be established. Are we going to allow ourselves to be straddled with, you know, this permanent dependence of people? You know, feed me, you know, take care of me, wipe my butt. No, we should not allow, enable bad behavior like that. I think that one of the most gracious and probably one of the most empowering and probably one of the most empathetic societies that there are is those societies that demand everybody become self-sufficient to their ability. And we have to understand that there are going to be people that can't be self-sufficient that we will have to take care of because it's not within their ability. And so when you actually have local community leaders, like way leaders, church leaders, community leaders, what have you, who know grandma can't put the roofing on, Grandma's not going to get that satellite dish on the ceiling on the roof. You can't see Grandma going up there to do that. Or maybe Grandma doesn't even have any children. Maybe Grandma has no family at all. Maybe, you know, a person that has disabilities. We will always, Christ told us, we'll always have those people with us. But if you have the ability to carry your own load, then the churches should be assisting you with the education, job placement, and the changing of your paradigm to get there. But right now, and this is what's going to end up happening, folks. The godless people will want to actually stop this because they know nobody will help anybody pour money into a worthless cause. It's just not good business sense. I mean, even Soros will not pour all of his money into being completely, it's a commitment to losing everything as he pours money into giving people to do whatever they want. In other words, if he created a church of compassion, go do your drugs, have your sex, and, you know, and be killed because you can't get it anywhere else, and he just pays for it, that's all he's doing is he's paying for the destruction of these lives. And that money's gone. But when we look at the investments of churches that, you know, they help people get back on their feet, they help them with education and skills and so forth so that they can go provide for themselves, now we have another person contributing to society that's actually, you know, assisting in the advancement of society, where Soros and these godless people are literally doing everything they can to stop society, to destroy it. So when it comes down to it, when nobody is contributing and somebody is pouring all the money in, who is that somebody? It is government taking the money from us and giving to those people that don't and won't. Now, 9 times out of 10, that's those people. When we see the homeless, there are people, there are percentages. I hate to be heartless and just callous. But when you create a system for people to game it, if it only takes one person to game it, it creates the wrong precedence, period. But it's not that case. We have seen over the course of this year alone, with Doge, everything else, we have proven that they have been taking marrow out of our backbone to destroy us by letting these leeches of destruction take this money and use it as weapons against us by buying things and throwing it away. I mean, the evil is so rampant and has been so rampant. Have we really stopped it? That's the real question. The only way we can truly know whether it's been stopped is whether our government is abiding by and fully compliant to the Constitution. That means they're not taking money for any purpose other than those enumerated objects, which means they're hardly taking any money out of our lives, which means that they're not putting money into the hands of our enemies. They're not putting money into our enemies to build them up and destroy us, either from within or from without. If we want to look at the real path forward that will take us centuries and centuries and centuries, we have to get compliant to the Constitution, because God gave us a government that would actually span, you know, a millennia easily, if not many millennia. With that, let's get into the Madison reports. Now, Tammy, did you have anything you wanted to add before we move forward?
No, I didn't.
Okay. So we just covered 18. Tammy finished reading 18, and I was just kind of summarizing some of the stuff that she read. So we just kind of covered the interesting vernacular, the dance of tongue, how Madison kind of walked through, you know, the rifle judges in the last resort, whether the bargain be made has been, where the bargain made has been pursued or violated. It's kind of a very elaborate way of saying, hey, you know, the states have this responsibility to determine whether that Constitution has been made, and they have that as the last resort. It is up to them to decide whether it's been made or not. Then he goes into this next part, that the Constitution of the United States was formed. He's reiterating the states now in a different way of saying it. Was formed by the sanction of the states given by each in its sovereign capacity. Remember, states are full sovereign and independent states. So in other words, they did this in their sovereign capacity, which adds to, he says, it adds to the stability and dignity as well as to the authority of the Constitution that it rests on this legitimate and solid foundation, on the solid foundation of all sovereign states have bought into this Constitution. He says, he then says, the states, again, then being parties to the Constitutional Compact, and in their sovereign capacity, it follows of necessity that there can be no tribunal above their authority to decide, in that last resort, whether the compact made by them has been violated, and consequently, that as the parties, I'm adding a couple of words here just to make it flow a little easier, that as the parties to it, they, the states, must decide themselves, or they themselves must decide, however you want me to put it, in the last resort, such questions as may be sufficient magnitude to require their interposition. In other words, how much energy and how much do we need to devote to interpose, to stop this? And how important is it that we have to do that? These are the kinds of questions that they have to ask themselves. Okay, so that's paragraph 18. Now, folks, from this paragraph right here and some of the many paragraphs we've already read, since we started with the Kentucky and Virginia resolutions, I cannot think of any other documents that are as eye-opening and as, you know, as blatantly, you know, important in understanding what to do when government is going awry. Do you not agree, Tammy? What do you think? Do you think these documents are probably the pinnacle or the epitome of what every patriot needs to read and understand to this degree? I mean, we really need to understand these very profoundly so that we can understand and hold our government accountable. What do you think?
They spell it out pretty clearly over and over.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, great. Great. And Sean?
I agree, sir.
Okay. Because then with no other comment, well, Sean, would you carry us through paragraph 19, please?
Gladly. It does not follow, however, because the states, as sovereign parties to their constitutional compact, must ultimately decide whether it has been violated, that such a decision ought to be interposed either in a hasty manner or on doubtful and inferior occasions.
Okay, so right there, what he basically just said is he says it doesn't follow, however, because the states, as sovereign parties to the constitutional compact, must ultimately decide. In other words, hold on here. They just took a bunch of pins and threw them away. Well, that was a waste of government property. They were perfectly good pins. They needed to use them. However, the pins were taking up space in a warehouse that needed that space for new things like computers that don't need pins anymore. And that because they don't use pins, because they have computers, they need to get rid of them. And they tried to donate them. So in other words, you go through this long series of questions and analysis to say, should we interpose with this decision to throw them away? Should we go after them because they wasted government money because it was an infraction of the law? Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
So he's trying to create this case as we see through here. And this is why what you're going to be reading in this next line is where he says, is it both willful and material? In other words, were they really trying to hurt us? Were they trying to kill us, to damage, what have you? So go ahead and read this next paragraph or this next series of questions, or I should say sentences, what have you.
Even in the case of ordinary conventions between different nations, where by the strict rule of interpretation, a breach of a part may be deemed a breach of the whole, every part being deemed a condition of every other part and of the whole, it is always laid down that the breach must be both willful and material to justify an application of the rule.
Okay, so hold on here. This actually goes both ways as far as whether you interpose and or nullify and secede. If you look in the Federalist Papers or through the ratification debates for a breach of the compact, if you look for compact or breach and you find that he's talking in this, you'll probably actually find Madison say this in Virginia, and you may find other people saying the same thing, that what he's talking about is the state itself gets to decide, because Jefferson already said this, that the state clearly can decide for itself if it is material and willful, or willful and material, that the state can decide to just nullify and say, this is beyond reproach. We don't want to have anything to do with the rest of you, which is really what the South did in seceding. And they had the right to do that. They had the right to do that because the Constitution, even though there were violations to the Constitution by, you know, all, whether you call it all parties, the South drove some violations like the Missouri Compromise and so forth. So they did these things instead of, you know, they to avoid their, you know, their comeuppance. In other words, the way the Constitution was designed, it was going to basically push slavery into extinction. The only way it survived is because they did the shenanigan of the Missouri Compromise. And so that's how they got more decades of slave labor done, because they got the Constitution violated. Okay, well, that violation begot other violations, where the other states came along and said, hey, we're going to come after you with tariffs and taxes and so forth that are going to make you miserable. Well, technically, they can't do that. The Constitution doesn't allow them to economically attack the other states, or to create conditions that create an advantage for the, you know, the non-slave states and a disadvantage for the slave states. So therefore, they saw those as both willful and material and said, we're out of here, because this is really about slavery. What you're doing is all about slavery. So that's why they stepped out. So anyway, go ahead, keep going.
Yeah, I'd like to just say that this reinforces for me the analogy you always use of the parents and the children and the federal government being the children.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
With the willful and material. Yep. Like your kids are nan-nan at each other. You're not going to just break out the law on them. You know, you're going to deal with it as you can. But if one of them throws the other off the stairwell or something, you have to step in.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, you do. Okay. You have to step in for one on an account of the other.
Right.
Right. Okay, so go ahead. The next one. But in, the case of
an intimate and constitutional union like that of the United States, it is evident that the interposition of the parties in their sovereign capacity can be called for by occasions only deeply and essentially affecting the vital principles of their political system.
Okay, so right there, he says, but in the case of an intimate, the intimacy is that the states have joined into a union, one to each other. We should be talking with each other on a regular basis. We should actually be looking at, you know, how can, you know, are we happy? Is this serving us, all of the states? And actually, you know, does, you know, why did they take this energy strategy and how is this serving us? If we were actually communicating as parties to the compact, is, in other words, as husbands and wives in a marriage, or as, you know, siblings all in this compact for this little thing we created, this federal government, to say, is this really serving us the way they're doing this energy plan, these energy strategies? It seems like they're selling us downriver. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
And so I believe that what he's saying here is that because of this intimacy, it is evident that the interposition of the parties in their sovereign capacity can be called for by occasions only deeply and essentially affecting the vital principles of that political system. So in other words, if they're literally killing us, we have to interpose. I think that makes sense. I want to say, boy, that makes sense to me. But, you know, sometimes people, they see things differently. You know, when they're spraying us to kill us, then, you know, that qualifies to me as, hey, you know, we need to stop this. Or when they're actually, you know, inflating our currency by, you know, just printing and printing and printing it, basically taking our property away from us, you know, that really has, these things have direct effects on us, the people, as well as the states. And so as we look at all the warfare that they're waging, we've got to step in today, folks, now. We'll be right back after the short promo.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so now would probably be the best time, because Sean, you brought this up from Wikipedia, of how the courts have basically said, no, interposition, not going to happen, you don't have the authority, sorry, end of story. And this is what Sean gave me out of Wikipedia. I'm just going to read this real quick because this is in Cooper v. Aaron. And, oh, by the way, this case happens to be in 1958. And so I need to look up this case because I want to find out what the issue was where people were trying to interpose. But bottom line, when it comes down to, and I'll say this, folks, it doesn't matter what the court thinks. It doesn't even matter what Congress thinks or the president thinks. If you have an entire state legislature, and let me just say this, if you have 3, 4, 5 state legislatures that are not only convinced, they are committed to compliance to the Constitution, that they must interpose in all of these, even ultra interpose, as necessary to preserve their sovereignty and so forth, then it doesn't matter what the federal government thinks or wants to do. The day the federal government being called out for violating the Constitution and can't actually defend itself because they don't have the jurisdiction to do so, then the day they say, well, you can't punish us, is literally the day where the crazies have taken over the institution completely. And I'm telling you right now, if states start standing up, that's only evidence that they haven't. Does that make sense? Because if there's somebody that can actually take over one quadrant, one 50th of this union of 50 states, where one set of legislatures say, sorry, you're not controlling this part of the insane asylum. And then other states stand up and say, sorry, you're not taking over this one either, this part. You're not taking over this cell block. Bottom line, as the states step in, the states can actually wield their authority. And as soon as they do, they can actually see, because I want to look at this Aaron v. Cooper, or Cooper v. Aaron.
Because I've got a little outline of it if you want to hear it.
I want to dig into it because I want to, you know, understand the inses and gazautas and all of that, because I want to see if they were seeking Section 3 of the 14th Amendment by removing people. I want to see if they were fully embracing full compliance. In other words, fully applying the Constitution properly. Or if they were just trying to use the Constitution to punish somebody with one facet and not comprehensively. Because bottom line, that usually tends to be a problem. Go ahead.
I said it was exactly like that.
Okay.
They used a case that the public opinion was for the interpretation that they gave out. So that gave them the added benefit of saying, oh, they're doing something good. It was about desegregation in Arkansas.
Ah, I see. There you go.
Yeah,
it was about civil rights.
They said that they're not bound by the Department of Education and the federal government. And they said they were because they were violating the rights of these people because of the color of their skin. So
Yeah,
it
so
was two wrongs making it what they wanted.
Yeah, but see, I think that this was a part of the plan. I mean, yeah. They needed these idiots to bring this forward so that down the road when legitimate interpositions take it, because to be clear, folks, you cannot leave the union when the federal government is adhering completely to and enforcing the Constitution. You try to rebel against the federal government. We did this with the Whiskey Rebellion just recently. You cannot rebel against the federal government enforcing the actual derived powers directly derivative out of those enumerated objects, like the Whiskey Rebellion on an excise tax. Can't do it. Those are legitimate. The only thing you can do is you can petition for the redress of grievances to say, hey, you're applying these things unfairly. And you may have a point of saying, because this is not uniform, this is not constitutional. You have that position, and that's alone. But when you try to actually go after the federal government for doing something that the 14th Amendment demanded, the segregation is illegal or unconstitutional. Separation but equal was a redefinition of equal protection under the law. That all people, when you walk into an institution such as a restaurant, if you're black and this is open to the public, every seat in that institute, if it's open to the public, every seat is open to any citizen. Which means they can't say you have to sit here, you have to sit there. If it's open, it's open. If you're a club, you're a membership only, then you can dictate how you want to operate. But when you're open to the public, you cannot create separations because of the 14th Amendment. So I wanted to just kind of read through this because they're basically rejecting this concept explicitly, because this is what the Supreme Court says. They're rejected interposition explicitly. This whole concept, not just what they were doing. The Supreme Court and lower federal courts have consistently held that the power to declare federal laws unconstitutional lies with the federal judiciary, not with the states. That's the whole point of why they did this. In other words, they don't want you to read what we have been reading to you just now and yesterday. They do not want you to know that the states actually are the only judges in these cases, because the judges and the courts cannot assume jurisdiction over things not delegated, actually forbidden. The Constitution only allows them to have jurisdiction over things arising under this Constitution. In other words, arising under it means it is in congruence, it is in pursuance to the Constitution. When it is in a violation to the Constitution from the federal government, that's when the states have to step in, because they don't have jurisdiction over their own violations. No person, no man, no woman can be a judge of themselves. When we allow that to happen, justice is gone. So, let's go back. As we get back into the break here, we're now on paragraph 20. And so, let's go ahead. And I think, Tammy, you're up. And so, let's go into paragraph 20 and dive into this case here. A little bit further. Go ahead.
Resolution has accordingly guarded against any misapprehension of its object by expressly requiring for such an interposition. The case of deliberate, palpable, and dangerous breach of the Constitution by the exercise of powers not granted by it, it must be a case not of light and transient nature, but of nature dangerous to the great purposes for which the Constitution was established. It must be a case, moreover, not obscure or doubtful in its construction, but plain and palpable. Lastly, it must be a case not resulting from a partial consideration or hasty determination, but a case stamped with the final consideration and deliberate adherence. It is not necessary, because the resolution does not require that the question should be discussed, how far the exercise of any particular power ungranted by the Constitution would justify the interposition of the parties to it. As cases might easily be stated, which none would contend ought to fall within that description. Cases, on the other hand, might with equal ease be stated so flagrant and so fatal as to unite every opinion in placing them within the description.
Okay, so there's a lot there. And as a matter of fact, to start off with, he basically goes back into this casing, or actually citing the resolution again. Quote, the case of deliberate, palpable, and dangerous breach of the Constitution by the exercise of powers not granted by it. How in the heck can the federal government have jurisdiction to sit there and say they're going to deliver justice to the states by, you know, by actually judging over itself in doing such egregious violations? Then it goes into, it must not be a case of light and transient nature, but a nature desirous to the great purpose for which the Constitution was established. Now, to me, this is probably about as mud can be. What do you think? Do you not agree with that, Tammy?
Yeah.
Okay. Because as he basically lays it out, that here we have this Constitution that was, you know, established to give them these powers. So they wanted to make sure that, you know, again, we don't want to, you know, it, we should actually have a notation of every infraction and maybe have them color-coded, you know, from, you know, green actions are all constitutional, and then slowly, you know, go from shades of, you know, from green to red, or whatever would be the logical spectrum of color, going from a good green to this ultra unacceptable red, so that we could actually go, wow, okay, these things, they wasted pens. You know, they didn't need paper, so they just wasted it. Instead of actually trying to sell that, you know, on the market value or what have you, to anybody that wanted to buy those things, so that, you know, they could recoup tax dollars without having to come back and tax us more. The government's not in the business of just saying, well, we can recklessly spend your money. So anyway, my point is that he's really, again, trying to emphasize this nuance that, you know, we want to make sure that they're really doing something bad, like it says, that these are palpable and dangerous breaches. And then he goes, lastly, it must be a case not resulting from a partial consideration or hasty determination, but a case stamped with a final consideration and deliberate adherence. In other words, we want to make sure that what they were doing, they knew what they were doing, and they were deliberately doing it, and then ramming it down, like what they did with, you know, the COVID vaccinations and all these other things that they did to us. So as he goes on, and he talks more about the ungranted by the Constitution would justify the interposition of the parties to it, as cases might easily be stated, which none would contend out to or ought to fall within the description. So in other words, we want to make sure that these aren't just hasty decisions, that in his opinion, this is placing us on a path of peril to our utter destruction. And that's what I think he says. So flagrant and so fatal as to unite every opinion in placing them within the description that we must interpose. So now he gets into paragraph 21. Paragraph 21 is kind of a transition paragraph that kind of sets up, you know, okay, so he has not talked about it. He's only said that the states are the parties. He said that the states could be the only final judges. He has not provided any justification as to why the federal courts cannot be, correct?
Yes.
Okay. So 21 is kind of the transition of going from this responsibility of, you know, the states of interposing and protecting the states and our sovereignty to actually help people understand why the federal government or the federal courts can't be the judge of themselves. So let's go ahead and go through paragraph 21.
But the resolution has done more than guard against misconstruction. By expressly referring to cases of a deliberate, palpable, and dangerous nature, it specifies the object of the interposition which it contemplates to be solely that of arresting the progress of the evil of usurpation and to maintain the authorities' rights and liberties appertaining to the states as parties to the Constitution.
Okay. So, again, focusing on arresting the progress of evil of usurpation. Right? So what was a usurpation in the Constitution? It was a direct violation right at the very top. When a representative in Congress cannot represent anything any more than 30,000 persons or 30,000 people. That right there is a usurpation when Congress says, no, we can make that 500,000. No, we can make that 1,000,000. They're usurping the authority to determine how many and who they can represent. They didn't get that power to do that. So in other words, they're assuming legislative power to be able to change what we have delegated to them not to exceed. So a usurpation isn't just like, you know, taking on the power of regulating energy. It can be the power of changing how they're going to serve us. And that's why when they go through direct violations, some of those things are literally usurpations. They may not seem like they're stealing something from us, but they are. When we have a right of suffrage and they watered down your suffrage from 30,000 to 1,000,000, that's a significant watering down and diluting your ability to have them represent you. Anyway, so Tammy, let's pick up 22.
Okay, from this view of the resolution, it would seem inconceivable that if it can incur any just disapprobation from those who laying aside all momentary impressions, and recollecting the genuine source and object of the federal Constitution, shall candidly and accurately interpret the meaning of the General Assembly.
Okay.
If the deliberate exercise of dangerous powers, palpably withheld by the Constitution, could not justify the parties to it in interposing even so far as to arrest the progress of the evil, and thereby to preserve the Constitution itself, as well as to provide for the safety of the parties to it, there would be an end to all relief from usurped power, the direct subversion of the rights specified or recognized under all the state constitutions, as well as a plain denial of the fundamental principle on which our independence itself was declared.
Okay, so that last highlighted part, if the deliberate exercise of dangerous powers palpably withheld by the Constitution could not be justified to the parties to it in interposing, even so as far as to arrest the progress of evil, and thereby to preserve the Constitution itself. I mean, this is a long-winded sentence, but as well as provide for the safety of the parties to it, there would be an end to all relief from usurped power. What that means is the degeneracy of the standards being maintained. Once they can start determining, well, we don't consider that really an infraction. Once they start assuming unconstitutional jurisdiction, that's a breach, that's a usurpation, then they can, you know, we get more and more convinced, well, we're at an age now where nobody questions the federal court's jurisdiction. Nobody. I'm serious. When I get in conversations left and right by so-called experts, patriots on the sovereign citizen side, what have you, these guys that claim they've been studying the Constitution for 40 years, not once did they ever say, well, this case was actually taken on by the federal court. They had no jurisdiction. But instead, what they say is the verdict coming off of this actually supports everything we're saying. You got to imagine the irony or the paradox that these people create for themselves.
Right.
What's even scarier is that we have good people that are judges that don't like what the federal government has done in some cases, but they just have to shake their heads and go, well, I wish they wouldn't have redefined it like that and instead said, you know, hey, we had no jurisdiction to even take that on, let alone redefine that part of the 14th Amendment. This is, you know, it becomes accepted. It's just like there's no patriot group out there challenging the veracity of the existence of the Department of Transportation. It's that one branch of government, or I should say Department of Government, that everybody just accepts as legitimate. This is why the presidents for the past several presidencies has used boondoggles for the Department of Transportation to bolster up our infrastructure with trillions of dollars to put into the pockets of their loyalists, and we see nothing why we have a decaying national transportation system when we shouldn't even have a national transportation system. They're robbing us of our money. Folks, what's it going to take? The fact that we're covering this content, the fact that we can point to these blatant violations left and right, all over the place, what's it going to take? Apparently, you know, and I'm just going to say this because, you know, we got some minutes to get into the next part of this. So what just recently happened was a huge downpour of rain into the Washington State and into the Pacific Northwest. And that's actually coming your way, folks. So it's a warm system that's coming your way because Montana and the mountains, you know, east of, and the plains that are going to be east of, are going to experience a warming up. And it's going to be warm for Christmas. I don't know how many of you have even thought about this, but maybe God is beginning to punish us. Maybe we'll have some, you know, seismic activity. I'll tell you what, if the Washington State area has seismic activity after its drenching that it's just gotten, maybe then the people of Washington might say, should we get on our knees and repent? Maybe. And we're so ignorant, and we've been so blinded as his children. This is such an indictment. It is such an indictment. But I don't like preaching. Don't want to be pointing my fickle finger of fate at anybody. So let's dive into Sean, paragraph 22. Now this is where he begins his retort on how the judiciary is the final arbiter. Go ahead, Sean.
Yeah, I was just going to say on that last part.
Yeah, go ahead.
In the highlighted, if the deliberate exercise, is he basically saying that if we don't do something about this right now, there's going to be no limit.
Yes.
And we'll lose our ability to keep them from going outside of the Constitution.
Yeah, yeah. So actually, in the, let me see if I can pull them up here. I don't think I have. Because I go through so many different documents. I'll pull it up really quick, because if you look in the Virginia Resolutions of 1798, and you look for the word degeneracy, and it comes up once, and it's right there in the sixth resolution. And he says, it would mark a reproachable inconsistency and criminal degeneracy if an indifference were shown to the most palpable violation of one of the rights thus declared. In other words, this is the beginning of a degeneracy. In other words, the erosion and the concept of, you know, us standing up for these rights or a standing up to a limited government, they break this hole open. They get through this. The water will erode eventually to a point where there's nothing left.
Right.
We're looking today. How much of the concept, Tammy? How much of the Constitution do you believe we have left?
6%.
You know what? I love that. I absolutely love that. And so we just lost Tammy as she was laughing. She probably accidentally hit the leave little icon on her desktop. So she'll probably come back. We'll hear her bing. But I love
that's like her Seinfeld moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Good night,
yeah.
Everybody. And she walks out.
Yeah, going out with on a high note. There she is. So welcome back, Tammy. That was just so funny. To me, when somebody just pulls a number out of the air, especially a small number or a huge number for emphasis effect, I think that's just great. I would venture to say that we're down to threads here. There are only threads of this cloth left clinging to, you know, to these fragments of what we have. And so it is, we're so worn down. And that's just because we've all been indoctrinated to accept everything. And sadly, people are waking up to fight back on these these small, I'll just call them the nuances, such as, you know, the conspiracies. Oh, we got to fight this. The first thing and the most important thing we got to fight is we got to fight our government, the unconstitutional authority of our government, and get our government back. We do that, everything else gets fixed. Everything else goes right. And when people are just convincing you to stand up against mask mandates, what's that going to do? The money and time that everybody goes in because it's the principle, we're going to die over stupid principles when we had the right to stand up for our government and force it into compliance. So anyway, let's get back to that part that we're going, but is it objected to if we finished answering your question there, Sean?
Oh, yes, sir.
Okay.
23?
No. Hold on. I thought it was 21. No, it is. It's 23. Yeah.
It's
23.
Yeah, it is.
But it is objected that the judicial authority is to be regarded as the sole expositor of the Constitution in the last resort. And it may be asked for what reason the declaration by the General Assembly, supposing it to be theoretically true, could be required at the present day and in so solemn a manner.
Well, so he's pointing to how the states pushed back and said, hey, the Supreme Court is the only expositor. They are the ultimate final arbiters, not the states. In other words, it's like these states forgot that they were members of the Union and somehow transitioned without an amendment to become subjects to a federal government that was created by the king or some other sovereign body by a charter. That Constitution is not a charter. That Constitution is a compact written for and by the states. Therefore, it is the creator of the creature. And therefore, the Union are the parties to the compact, i.e., Madison kept going through this and through this and through this. And so now he's finally saying, hey, look, you guys are objecting because you're claiming that only the courts have the authority to be this final arbiter. And so now he dives into it. And so he basically lays this out, but it's being objected because of this. Okay, so Tammy, let's lead on with Madison's parries and thrusts as he takes this sword duo to the death.
Time.
Okay, we've got about 20 seconds left.
Oh, you know what? Then thank you so much for looking. I think that's what Sean meant by time. So yes, anyway, yeah, we've got a few different 5 seconds. Really quick around Robin. Sean, anything to add before we come back tomorrow?
No, sir.
And Tammy?
Nope.
Okay.
We're out of time.
we got a few more, about 15, 20 seconds. Okay, so with that, folks, I really hope that this all starts to make sense. I hope that everything that we're seeing here, and as a matter of fact, everything that Madison's laying out, is basically refuting how the federal courts, how these judges have assumed power well beyond their capacity in operating under this Constitution. How did it happen without amendments? It was by self-assumption and usurpation. So, as we lay it out, folks, we're giving you the facts. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.